Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. Today's show features Cindy K. Olson. Cindy is an author, speaker, entrepreneur, and co-founder of Choice Strategic Alliance. She was the Executive Vice President of Global Human Resources for the Enron Corporation until its bankruptcy in 2001. Cindy, I am so excited to have you here with me today. I just know we're just going to have so much fun because we always do.
You are right about that. We always have fun.
We always have fun and we always have more to talk about, it seems like, than we have the time for.
That's right.
But I am so excited for our listening audience to get to know you as I have. And let's just jump right in because we got a lot of things to discuss. So talk to me a little bit about kind of how you grew up and then, you know, your early career and like jump in.
Okay, so I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, and middle class and a very, very strong family life, extended family, and really only worked for three companies in my life. I started working for Koch Industries in Wichita, Kansas, and then Grady, my husband of 43 years, we moved to Omaha, Nebraska, and I started working for InterNorth, which became Enron. And I've got a lot of things to talk about in terms of that career, but it was a pretty simple life growing up, you know, and my family is all still close, and most of the family did not leave Wichita. Grady and I were really two of the three or four that decided to take off and try something else in another part of the country.
Right, and they probably didn't quite understand why you were leaving at the time, right?
No, they didn't.
Yeah, because we have a similar story. We also have a lot of similarities, but one of the similarities is you have an accounting education.
I started as
an accountant, right?
I did. That was my degree. I was trying to decide between an accounting degree or I was also majoring in French. And then I realized that, what were you going to do with French, right? So the accounting degree served me well.
Right. So that's kind of your early career journey. So you ended up in Omaha and you were working for InterNorth. Right?
We're InterNorth, and it was one of the, I'd say, the largest and most respected companies in Omaha. Mm-hmm. And about 7-8 years into my career, InterNorth was purchased, or really, InterNorth and Houston Pipeline merged. And I was ready for an adventure. We had been there for 7 or 8 years. I was kind of tagged as a future leader. I loved change, and I loved the idea of something new. And so when Enron was created by these two companies, it was pretty clear that the opportunities were going to be in Houston.
Right.
And so I was one of the first ones to raise my hand and say, I'll go.
Right.
And I remember getting the opportunity to be able to lead my first transformational project, because if you think about it, Enron was formed by bringing 5 pipelines together, different cultures, and there was lots of work to do.
McKinsey was our
consultant that we used, and so I got to spend almost 23 years working with McKinsey, transforming different organizations within Enron. It was a fabulous career.
Yeah, there would have been a lot of change leadership that had to happen in that, you know, bringing those 5 pipelines. I want to back up 1 minute, though, and I want to go back to InterNorth and talk about something where I believe there was a situation where one of the managers left, and then there was an open spot. you were up against a gentleman, and we're both women, you know, and so for the women out there, they know what we're talking about, but sometimes there are hurdles that women have to overcome, and you had a lot then, right? I mean, Inner North, you were seeing that there were some women that were in leadership positions. I want you to talk about that. What did you do, Cindy, when that spot came open?
I just talked about the things that I'd done, and I was always looking for I call it a mess to clean up. And so I had a lot of opportunities to highlight, because I was in internal audits too before this job came open. And there were a lot of things that our team found. So when you talk about real value to the business, I could identify those. And I learned a lesson from that, not only from being a woman in a really male-dominated field, okay, but also the fact that if you really want to get noticed, then pick a real mess and volunteer to clean it up.
Right.
Right?
It kind of seems counterintuitive, really, you know, because who wants to deal with a mess? But if you are confident in your skills and you were good at what you did, I mean, you were really good, I believe, at figuring out what was really going on and finding some places where the company maybe could save money, that sort of thing. So you're able to quantify.
Right.
That's the word I'm looking for.
Yep.
You're able to quantify what you had done.
I learned that early on, that you had to be able to identify your value in terms of what it meant to the business. So it was all about quantifying what you'd done. And so from an early part of my career, that dates way back into the Inner North days, I learned that, and I carried it with me the whole time. And I always really looked at it. I had a manager. Once I got to Houston, there was a manager that taught me that basically if you want to keep your role, okay, then you had to show that you added a lot more value than what you cost the organization. And I thought he was a pretty tough manager, but that was unbelievably good advice and training for me as I went into future roles in the organization that became higher and higher roles.
Yeah, so I think that there's a couple lessons in there. You know, having the confidence and the boldness to say, hey, I'll apply for that, even if it's a mess, and then really being able to articulate and know what value you're bringing to the organization.
That's exactly right.
So
the other thing I've got to say is, as I look back, Enron was a company that allowed you to do that. And it wasn't necessarily that you applied for a new job. It was that you raised your hand and you took on projects. And you even though you were in a role, I would raise my hand and I would say, I want to be the one that leads the reconciliation project between the risk books and the accounting books. Or I want to be the one that figures out how we go from a supplier diversity number of only about 1% of our spend to 30%. So I would raise my hand for projects that were additional to my job.
Right.
And it's really interesting because I didn't really ever ask for more money, but because I did those things, the money came, right?
Right, but it followed.
Yeah, it followed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a combination of asking for the projects, doing a good job, and then also being able to quantify. I love the fact that Enron was like that and gave everyone the opportunity to do that, because in a lot of companies, you don't really get that opportunity.
That's right. But that keeps you engaged,
right?
And excited. Let's move on. I do want to talk more about Enron now. You loved Enron.
I did.
I loved Enron.
And it's really, in my role today, I work with CHROs all over the country about really next gen technology and all the things that are on the horizon around talent. And it's hard for me not to say, you know, we were doing that in 1999 because we had an employee value proposition that allowed people to move around the organization and get new skills. We called it an open market for talent, where we were rewarded for what we did. I remember when I asked for HR, okay, because I really, really wanted to improve the organization that I thought was so important to our trading operation, because we had to have really smart people. But when I did ask for HR and they promoted me to the executive committee, they raised my pay to the same amount that any of the men on the executive committee made. And I remember saying to Ken Lai, that's a lot of money. And he just smiled and said, you deserve it. But the women in Enron were paid just like the men were paid. And so, you know, it's a combination of the opportunity that we were given and then the fact that we were rewarded just like men were. Everybody was equal. And then I think the other part was that we were equity owners in the business. Every single person was an equity owner
right.
at Enron.
You had stock.
We had stock.
Uh-huh.
And it was everyone. And so it's really hard to be able to look at companies today and think, oh my gosh, where would I go work if I was going to work for another company that would give me that kind of experience, right? Mm-hmm. And what's been interesting as I've reconnected with people, because I loved everyone at Enron, right? I go back and I say, what do you remember about Enron? And they, most of the time, they will say, you know, if I could go back and work at Enron, even if I knew the end was 2 years away, I'd do it in a heartbeat because I'll never get that energy level or that engagement level again. So it was a great place, and that's not what most people think,
right?
When they think of Enron.
Well, because they think of the latter days.
That's right. That's right.
But you were there for what, 23 years?
I was there for 23 years.
23 years. And so, I mean, I know you've told me that so many times that you felt like you worked with the best and the brightest. The culture was so innovative. So I know at the time that, Enron was being listed, Forbes here, Fortune here. Tell us a little bit about some of those. I want to make sure that I don't want to say it because I want to make sure that
well,
I get it right.
And it was what was interesting was most people don't know that in 2001, early 2001, we were named for the 6th year in a row the most innovative company by Fortune. If when you go back and look at what other companies have done that in the past, it was only Apple. So it's been Enron and Apple. And the iPhone was not invented until 2004, so 3 years after Enron imploded. So we were definitely innovative. But if you go look at some of the accolades, because when we were named the most innovative company for the 6th year, Ken Lay got all these CEOs asking, can you come tell us how you created this innovative culture? And I got to go do that. So I went out and trained leadership teams at Goldman Sachs and American Express and Charles Schwab on exactly what it took to create that innovative culture. And one of the slides that I used was the accolades, okay? We were on every magazine cover. We were like number 4 in talent, number 1 in management skills. I mean, if you look at all the Fortune and Forbes lists that we were on, we were the 22nd best company to work for. So there was a lot of things that I was pretty proud about, you know,
Absolutely.
In 2001.
Yeah, you were on the executive committee. You were the CHRO for a 25,000 employee, multi-billion dollar company that had all these accolades.
That's right.
What's not to be proud about, right?
Fortune 7. And, you know, I look today at market cap. Our market cap was $60 billion. And that is small compared to like Apple and Facebook and some of those today. But it was Fortune 7 at the time. And we had $100 billion of revenue. So it's a pretty big company we're talking about.
Oh, well, goodness, there are so many things that we could talk about there. But what I do want to talk about is you love change, you love adventure, you love, you know, raising your hand for something brand new. But there was a time where you went through a lot of change, a lot of change. And so talk about that a little bit. Talk about a few of the lessons that you learned. And there's so much we could talk about here, but
you have that right. So I always used to say I love change, and I did love change, but when that much change happens to one person at once, it's pretty rough, and it's life-changing. But I will say, all the things that I went through, and I would say we when I talk about that, because we all went through it, right? But the things that we went through made us better people. And specifically, let me talk about, like, me. The change was hard. Okay, I was the first one to testify in front of the Senate and the House, in front of how many millions of Americans on TV, right? And I went from being a CHRO and on the executive committee of a Fortune 7 company to pretty much nothing, right? So your identity changes, and you wrap so much of yourself in your role. And so you have to overcome that, right? And then there's just a lot of change in your lifestyle. We were going to every event that you can imagine. It was a Hollywood lifestyle. But along with that goes arrogance. And one of the things that I do when I speak, and this is a big lesson that I learned, I was pretty arrogant. I got to a point where I was the CHRO of the 7th largest company in the world, and I was pretty special, right? I've got a friend that always says things like, you were cuter than you thought you were, right? And I was. I mean, I was. When Enron happened, that made me into a better person. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, and it made a lot of us identify with who we were, not mm-hmm. what we were. And
or
so,
what you did.
Yeah, or what you did. And mm-hmm. I think many people go through that and it's very difficult. But man, if you can make it out to the other side, and I had such a supportive husband. If you can make it out the other side, you are so much stronger. That's when I really understood how much faith that Ken Lay had. Because he had a lot of faith, but because I didn't really have my own faith, you don't see that in other
people. You
knew
there was something different about him.
Yeah.
But you probably couldn't put your finger on it.
No, I couldn't. And he would say things like, I went in, Ron, to be the company where people use their God-given talents to do more than they ever thought they could do. And it was that. Enron was that. But I never really understood that until I had my own faith. Going through the hard times, I tell people all the time, yeah, it was great living that lifestyle. It was great being in that role. But you know what? I wouldn't change it for a minute because I'm a much better person. And it gave me an opportunity to do something else mm-hmm. and reinvent myself.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with Cindy K. Olson. Cindy, talk to us a little bit. Are there any other lessons that you learned from your whole Enron experience that you want to tell the audience about?
Yeah, there is. And let me just back up for 1 second and talk about why Enron even failed. Because I think a lot of people have a misconception, especially I get a lot of questions. What do you think of the smartest guys in the room? I get that question a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's everybody's really point of understanding Enron is that documentary. So the thing about that documentary is they talk about Enron being imploding because of the accounting and the trading. And honestly, that's not why we imploded. The trading organization was unbelievably profitable. And we balanced our books every night. I know because I was in charge of balancing the risk books every night. Mm-hmm. And our accounting was approved by Arthur Andersen. And everyone knows how great they were, right?
Right.
Arthur Andersen and Vinson and Elkins. And we even had mark-to-market accounting approved by the SEC. But what happened was there were a lot of things that were legal. So we had a team of legal people. We had a team of accounting people, and they all blessed everything that it was legal. But what I've learned, the biggest lesson that I've learned through this whole Enron thing is legal and ethical are glaringly different. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, legal, we checked all the boxes. Mm-hmm. Okay? We did. Mm-hmm. Everything was legal. The way we manipulated prices in California, the way that we used our market power in California was not ethical. Some of the accounting that we used was legal. But if you added it all up and all the off-balance sheet partnerships that we used for the sole purpose of improving our credit score, mm-hmm. which again was legal, it wasn't ethical.
Mm-hmm.
So the biggest lesson that I think everyone needs to understand from Enron is that you can be in a company where everything is checked and tied and ticked and it's legal, but then you really need to ask that last question, is it really something I should do? One of the Enron executives, Mike McConnell, a good friend of mine, he wrote a book, a children's book, actually. And the title of the book was, Just Because You Can Doesn't Mean You Should. And so I would say that there's a lot of lessons from Enron, but I would say that one for me was the lesson that I walked away with that I think applies to so many people in grad school, in college now, in business now. Don't just look at, is it legal? Make sure that you're doing a check with your ethics and that everything you're doing.
That is really powerful. Thank you for sharing that. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, what do you feel like the something extra is that every leader needs and every company needs?
That's a great question. And I really believe that if you really step back, the issue that leaders have in public companies, they answer to Wall Street, right? And so you have so much pressure to perform. Mm-hmm.
For the shareholders.
Yeah. And we were mm-hmm. rewarded to be, and I call it clever, because we had ways to figure out how to be legal but get around the rules. And I think the something extra that leaders have to have is almost courage to be able to say, no, just because it's legal doesn't mean that it's ethical. And I know my share price might suffer, But in the long term, I need to make the ethical and the right decision, not necessarily the one that's going to give my shareholders more value in their stock price. So when I think about something extra, it's having that extra filter that you really look at the ethics and use a different barometer than just, is it legal and mm-hmm. are we actually being compliant with the regulation? Mm-hmm. Go farther.
And that does take courage.
It does take courage.
Because in a public setting, you have so much pressure, don't you?
Right.
I mean, pressure from every side.
Right.
So that is great. I love that. The something extra's courage. I love that. So following on with that, you know, is there somebody in your life or somebody that you worked with? It could be, you know, a boss. It could be a colleague.
Yeah.
That really want to bring out, you know, talk about that person. What was the something extra that made them so extraordinary?
So I'm going to go back to Kinlay because I was very fortunate that I got to spend 7 years almost daily with him. Because when I took over HR, you know, that's a role that has to be tightly tied to the CEO. And the mm-hmm. CEO and the CHRO have got to be very close in
right.
terms of their thoughts. And the something extra that Ken had was his faith, one, okay? He had a lens that he treated people around how Jesus would treat people, right? And mm-hmm. he was always talking to people in the elevator about what they did. I'll never forget running into an ex-Enron employee in Dallas, and he tells a story about being on the elevator his first day at Enron. And Kinlay gets in the elevator, and Ken starts the conversation. I haven't seen you around here. Who are you? Where did you come from? And his name was Ken Reeves. His name was Ken, too.
Right.
And so as Kinlay got off the elevator, he said, well, I'm glad you're here. And by the way, you have a great name. My name's Kinlay, too. Because he didn't know he was talking to Kinlay.
He didn't know that
right?
it was the CEO.
That was the something extra that you got with him, which was he wasn't just your leader. He was someone that really cared. When Enron was imploding, we were all going through all the stuff we were going through. He would write personal notes to all of us about, he knew some of the things we had to do. He wanted us to know that he loved, you know, that he loved us. And that's something extra, right? You don't get that
you
from a lot
that.
Of leaders.
That's right.
So I use that as my kind of metric, you know.
I
He was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I remember you say, like, even when he would call you, it was always like, Cindy, this is Kinlay.
Oh, yeah, like I didn't know it was Kinlay, right?
It was Ken.
Oh, he'd always say that, Cindy, this is Kinlay. And
right.
I'd laugh and I'd say, I know Ken, I know it's you.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was just
And you said he always asked you, you know, how are you and Grady doing? What's going on with you? I mean, he took a personal interest. And this is a gentleman that's leading a 25,000 employee company.
That's right.
But he took the time.
I remember one of my really good friends at Enron, she was a vice president in the pipeline group. She lost her son, and Ken had written her a long letter about how he was so sorry, you know, that she'd lost her son. And I was walking out of the building with her, and she looked at me, and she goes, you are so lucky that you get to work every day with him. And I said, I know I am. And, you know, it's very interesting because Ken died in 2006, but Ken's widow, Linda, and Grady and I have become very good friends. And she is the same way. She'll always mm-hmm. say, how's Grady? How's your dad? You know, so
right.
it's just that special extra thing from someone that is supposedly a leader of one of the largest companies. It's not very common. It really creates in people commitment,
mm-hmm.
you know, not just compliance with what you need to do, but a commitment to the company.
Mm-hmm.
And people talk every day, because I'm around CHROs, they're trying to figure out how to retain their talent. Retain your talent by treating your employees like that, right?
Right.
Because then they're committed to you.
Absolutely.
And they want to do.
There's a loyalty
there. There's a loyalty, right?
But, you know, I'm just thinking about the leader. There's got to be something supernatural going on with that leader to be able to do all that they're doing with the company and to show that much personal interest. I mean, it really, truly is. There's an old ancient proverb that talks about, you know, esteeming others more than yourself. And that's just so counterintuitive, is it not, to our culture?
It is.
Cindy,
I mean, that was what I realized was he had such strong faith. And He did. I realized it afterwards in talking to his wife. But that's what drove his behavior. Mm-hmm. His faith and the way that he treated people mm-hmm. was the way that we all basically see Jesus, right? And so I'm not saying that Kinlay is Jesus. I'm just saying that if you look at the Bible and you look at your faith, that's what you're supposed to do, you know?
Right.
And leaders, I think, sometimes they go to church on Sunday and they leave their faith on the pew and they don't bring it to work and practice that.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was an integrated thing
yes,
with him.
Yes, it was an integrated thing mm-hmm. with him, and it was part of him.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't afraid to be real and care about people.
That is just so powerful, so powerful. So I want to talk a little bit, because I want to give you the opportunity to kind of talk about what you're doing today. But the first thing I want you to do, though, Cindy, I mean, you have been in HR for a very long time, and you have seen the evolution, right? So can you define for us the modern day CHRO? Because, you know, it's not just pushing paper anymore.
No, it's not. No, it's
not. You're setting culture. You're doing all kinds of things. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
I think that you've got to realize that CHROs really are there to enable the business, right? And now the business is requiring talent because the talent shortage, and they're requiring talent from all different areas. When I look back on why I might have been successful in my role as a CHRO, I came from the business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think CHROs have to understand the business. It's very critical now for them to understand what the business requires and how they enable the business. I think it's the same for CIOs, quite frankly, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I think the CHRO and the CIO have a unique opportunity today to be a leader in the talent effort of an organization so that talent is a business initiative and the CHRO is leading it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just them helping, but it's them stepping up and saying, I've got this. I need to lead talent in my organization and come up with new and creative ways of where to find it, how to utilize it. And technology is offering the opportunity to do that. So CHROs have to understand technology. They really do.
Mm-hmm.
They understand the business. They have to understand technology, and they have to work hand in hand with their CIO.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I'm fully on board with that. I totally believe that. So talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing as some of the disruptors going on right now. So I know that you study Gartner, you're on the McKinsey reports, all of that. So what are the trends that are coming up, and what do you think we all need to be on the lookout for?
So the trends are obviously going to the cloud, and everything is SaaS, right? And so the days of big implementations from an IT and technology standpoint are gone. And if you're not looking at technology that gives you that kind of ease of implementation, and then the whole AI and the whole predictive analytics. So you've got to be looking for predictive analytics, not just analytics, right? But predictive. How do you understand what's going to happen to you, right? And then I think it's really important to also start looking at how do we do things at home? Like, how do we talk to Alexa, and how do we turn? We talk to basically a technology, right?
Right.
So we've got to be able to do that at work. And if you're not looking at technology that does some of that, then you're not in the disruptor space. You're in the, we always say at Choice, so the company I work for, Choice Solutions, we offer next-gen infrastructure technology, and we don't want our clients to be boxed in by buying something that's not the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things that we always try to do is at least share with them what that future looks like for technology.
Mm-hmm. So talk to us about the fun thing that you're doing around the country right now. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
So this is the reinvention and where I think the Enron background has played a positive role in what I'm doing today. So my passion is really helping the business be better and helping the CHRO to be that kind of CHRO I just described. So I'm building in partnership with ADP, quite frankly, because most people think ADP is a payroll company, and they're so innovative. But we've got 400 CHROs around the country, 7 cities, really strong world-class thought leaders to share insights with these CHROs about things maybe they haven't thought about, right? And so I'm trying to keep them apprised of what the future looks like, because I remember the role I was in, you were so busy with day to day and just, you know, handling your job that looking at the future and what was out there was really kind of tough.
That was tough.
So I'm having a ball bringing people together, helping them with insights into disruptive technology and just trends. So it's fun.
Right. And what you're doing is you are grooming them. You're helping them elevate to the next level, right?
Right.
So that they can lead their companies in a really innovative and bring that value
exactly.
that we had talked about before.
Exactly. See, I don't think I'll ever be able to run an HR organization again, because nobody's going to want the ex-CHRO of Enron. But think about how many CHROs I can help if I'm doing this. And that's the thing that's driving me and the passion, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's your passion project.
It's my passion project.
I love it. That is so exciting what you're doing, and I see the need for it. I really do see the need for it. More education, knowledge is power. So if there is a CHRO or an aspiring CHRO even out in our listening audience that wants to get involved in this, how would they go about that?
So they need to contact me at Cindy@CindyKOlson.com. That's the easiest email that they can use. I'll get in touch with them and get them plugged into whatever city that they're in. Love to have them.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. This has just been such a delight.
Thank you. Love you, Lisa.
Love you, too.
Our show today is executive produced by Brian Muncy. Our technical producer is Daniel Williams. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2018. For show notes or to reach out to Lisa, visit lisagailnichols.com/somethingextra. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen.